Well, Dr. Dembski, we'd like to thank you for being here, especially in the middle of a full day for you. I thought I'd begin by asking you to share just about how you came to faith in Christ, and then also knowing that maybe some here attended secular colleges and universities, maybe you could share how your faith was challenged or refined during your time in secular institutions.
Yeah. Well, I don't think intelligent design really played much of a role in my conversion. I think what was crucial there was it was at a difficult time in my life. I had left high school a year early, and after that I was just kind of floating. I was not a Christian. I'd been raised nominally in a Catholic home, but there was no real faith there. In fact, I remember going to Catholic church and this one Catholic priest once saying, you know, to be a Christian, you must believe that Jesus is the son, not just the Son of God, but that Jesus was God himself, is God himself. And I just remember consciously saying, I don't believe that, you know, consciously saying to myself. So there's no Christian faith there at the time, but I was went to college without a high school diploma, went to the University of Chicago, spent some time there, then transferred to another place, transferred to still another place, just was really floating around, not really knowing what I was doing, where I was going. And then turned out that my mother had become a Christian through a women's meeting and started plying me with, you know, gospel literature and got me reading the Bible. And so that's, you know, that's how faith really came. I started thinking about the claims of Christ anew. I'd been involved in what now would be called New Age thinking, you know, sort of Eastern mystical stuff, which I think really did sort of a number on me. But this brought me out. And I think what was really the turning point was I had this sense that there was a God, but it wasn't clear, you know, who or what this God was. And also, there was a sense that whatever this God was, you know, this God was just inaccessible. How could I get to this God? You know, because it just seemed so far removed. And when I understood the incarnation, that in God, in Jesus Christ, God became flesh, that just the light bulb went on, because here was a God that could relate to the human condition. You know, and even I was 18 or 19 at the time, but that somehow was very meaningful to me. That this God, it would seem so remote. You know, and I had a vague sense that, you know, this God was behind the creation, that there was something marvelous about the creation, but that this God could care enough about humanity to take on flesh in Jesus Christ, that somehow made a real difference for me. And it was shortly after that that I was reading the Sermon on the Mount, actually, and said, you know, I want to commit myself to this. And so it was, you know, then reading the scriptures that faith came. Hmm. Yeah.
And during your studies, did you find struggles and opposition to that faith?
Well, it's funny. I don't think there was. There was never a place where, you know, I felt overwhelmed by an intellectual case that somehow made Christianity seem implausible. I mean, that, you know, that never really was the case. I remember, you know, certain early on, maybe there was one case where question of the authority and accuracy of Scripture was really challenged, and I had to think my way through that. But it seemed that always there were resources. You know, always God would bring me back to apologetic resources. You know, F.F. Bruce or J.I. Packer or various people. You know, Francis Schaeffer. These were formative influences early in my reading, and that always, you know, it seemed that, you know, the intellectual problem wasn't it. And early on, also, you know, the Darwinian evolution seemed very implausible to me, and these sorts of probabilistic arguments that I've developed now. Formally, even back then, you know, the sense that what is within the capacity of chance mechanisms to accomplish? Because Darwinian mechanism is ultimately a chance mechanism. I know people will say, well, it's not really chance because you've got natural selection operating. But as Darwin himself said it, unless variations give you something advantageous, natural selection can do nothing. You know, so all the creative work ultimately belongs to chance. Chance needs to be able to come up with the right errors in order for natural selection to do anything. So right from the start, that seemed very implausible. And I think that, you know, maybe that helped preserve me in some ways, because, you know, the challenge of evolutionary theory and naturalism was never never really, you know, that never really cut any ice with me, right from the earliest times of my my Christian faith. Mm-hmm. You know, which is interesting also because I was raised in a home where my dad was a biologist, and he even taught evolutionary theory. He was a PhD biologist, taught at a local community college, or it's actually City Colleges of Chicago. And, you know, it was, you know, the evolutionary story was just presupposed by him, you know, and so I, you know, and I accepted that growing up, you know, but once I started looking into it, you know, just didn't, I found it unconvincing, you know.
I recently watched the PBS special on entitled What About God that originally aired in 2001, mm-hmm. and it seems to paint the picture that a religious person can either be kind of a mindless anti-scientific creationist, and they feature Ken Ham and kind of make a mockery of him, or you can be a theistic evolutionist and they feature the Wheaton College Science Department. And I was wondering if you could comment on a couple things about that program. First of all, how you feel about your position not really being represented in a documentary like that. And then maybe also you could, I know you mentioned theistic evolution this morning and talked about it a little bit, but maybe you could explain to us more of what that is and how you would critique it.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that series because that was one of the 7 or 8 parts in that PBS Evolution series. And that was the very last last episode there, and actually the producers did approach Discovery Institute and so the design group to have us on the segment, but we consciously decided, you know, we're not going to do it because programs like this, I mean, it was clear that this was going to be a hatchet job on us, that there, you know, there was an agenda there, and when that happens, I mean, they've already written the script, you know, they're just going to take, you know, they're going to take enough film, and then they're going to just slot you, so you get fitted into the script. And we just didn't want that. And beyond that, you know, intelligent design, yes, you know, as Christians, we can say it provides us, you know, it's pointing to the Christian God. And yet, it stands as a scientific research program. It doesn't, you know, we don't have to bring in God or the Bible, you know, to do this. And it just seemed that it would misrepresent what we were about, you know, because, and I'll say that, you know, when I characterize intelligent design, I will say that there are three aspects to it. One is as a straight scientific research program, and it does serve that. Then as a program, as an intellectual and cultural program for challenging naturalism, you know, so it goes beyond the science, has implications, much as Darwinism has implications beyond science, and then also as a way of trying to understand divine action. But the scientific program is really the key, and if that can't be made to work, then anything we build on top of it won't work either. And so it just seemed like it was going to misrepresent what we were about, and so we refused to be part of the program, and I'm glad we did. Now, in terms of theistic evolution, I think the problem that I and my colleagues have had with theistic evolution is that usually it takes the Darwinian picture, whatever the current naturalistic picture of evolution is, and baptizes it, says that's the way God did it. Now, intellectually, that's an uninteresting position. I mean, just to say, well, God did it that way. But you know, from our vantage, there are real scientific problems with Darwinian theory, and so let's deal with them. You know, and those scientific problems point up that you know, that there is, it's not just that there's a problem with Darwinism, but also that the very things that are pointing to problems in Darwinism are also pointing us to design. And so, you know, intelligent design, there are lots of different people associated with the movement. You have somebody like Michael Behe, who will hold to what's called common descent or common ancestry, all organisms tracing their ancestry back to a last universal common ancestor. But he does not believe that there was a blind mechanism that led to all of that. For him, there's design operating through the evolutionary process, and that design is detectable, it's discernible. And this is what theistic evolution, by and large, doesn't allow. For theistic evolutionists, and you know, I'm painting with a broad brush, but that's typically how it comes across. It's that the naturalistic story is just fine, that's the way God did it. But when we do the science, there's nothing about the history of life which points us to an intelligence. It's like the example I gave in chapel this morning about somebody, you know, at a football stadium. You have everybody there flipping coins, and you keep having the people who flip heads or flip tails sit down, and at the end you have somebody who flipped 15, 17 heads in a row, and you say, you know, isn't it amazing that this person has flipped 17 heads, when it's just a statistical, you know, expectation that that's going to happen. And that's what I see the theistic evolutionist really having to agree to, that, you know, it's a blind material process. Nothing about that process points us to God. It's just that for theological reasons or other reasons, then we will say, well, that's how God did it. But that seems it's a logical possibility that God did it that way, but, you know, it's certainly not necessary, and the evidence seems to point to that there really are signs of intelligence in the biological world. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think the intelligent design position is much more interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You mentioned Michael Behe. Maybe you could clarify a little what, since he holds to common descent, what would the similarities and differences be between him and a theistic evolutionist?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Behe is not dogmatic about common descent. I mean, I think he feels that that's where the best evidence points at this point. But, you know, as I said, how did this all this diversity and complexity of life arise? Because if you hold to common descent, I mean, it's basically the picture of life that you have is this great tree of life. You have some initial common ancestor, and then everything ramifies out. And how did you get that? Now, his view is that this was programmed by God, that there was design there, and that it, you know, I mean, he speculates here. I mean, he doesn't know the details, you know, and nobody does really at this point. But, you know, he's saying that one possibility is that there was a supercell which had all the information in there, and it just, and it's just been expressed now in different ways. You can think of sort of a computer program that will, at various times, kick in and have different behaviors. So that's how he thinks of it. But the crucial thing is that the design in biology, that it is something you can get a handle on scientifically. I mean, he does it through his concept of irreducible complexity. He says, you know, here's a well-defined notion. You can say, okay, is this system irreducibly complex or is it not? You know, you just run the test. You figure it out. You know, because irreducibly complex systems have certain features, well-defined. Figure it out. Okay, it's irreducibly complex. Now, what sort of material mechanism could give rise to that? And he argues, I think, quite forcefully that the Darwinian mechanism, which is really the only thing that the scientists have at this point to try to account for systems like this, can't hack it. So, and then you have also that these systems, the features they exhibit, this irreducible complexity, this functional integration of many parts, that this is something we do all the time with inventions. You know, computer, you name your favorite human artifact, you know, your contrivances. They're multi-part systems that arise through a conception. You know, somebody has an idea, has a plan, to accomplish some purpose, and they put the parts together. And the parts are all integrated in a way. I mean, it's not like you can just leave some off and then it'll still do what it needs to do. So, there's more. I mean, you know, you flesh that out, but I mean, that's his basic argument. And the intelligent design people, what they're committed to is that the design is real and it's detectable. Okay, just how it got expressed. You know, there's quite a bit of, you know, divergence. But I wouldn't say, you know, there's no sharp argument or disagreement, you know, where people are at each other's throats. There isn't. I mean, there's a lot of goodwill, I find, in the community. But Behe is, I would say, at one extreme, and then you'll have, I mean, there are young Earth creationists who are intelligent design people, you know, and who will see it as much more discrete, you know, separate in creation events, you know, and then you'll have various kinds being created, and then there'll be some microevolution from those kinds, you know. But those are the options. But, you know, the commitment is to empirical detectability, that we can know it when we see it. We can know that there is design there, and that natural forces, blind natural forces, are inadequate. And it's interesting. I mean, you know, because I think to you know, the word, this adjective blind, you know, is doing some useful work there, because it's, you know, it's you know, just how the designer decides to express himself, you know, in natural history. I mean, there are lots of possibilities, you know. But I was at an event at the American Museum of Natural History. This is a debate where Behe and I squared off with some Darwinists, Ken Miller, who's quite well known, and Rob Pennock. You know, and initially that program was titled Blind Evolution or Intelligent Design? Right before the program, they dropped the word blind, and it was evolution or intelligent design? Now, evolution as such, if it's just change over time, organisms changing, you know, over time, and perhaps, you know, through a process of generation, one transforms into another, would be compatible with intelligent design, provided that this is some sort of programmed evolution where God's purposes or a designer's purposes are being expressed, you know. But and so I think it would have been good if they had kept the adjective blind there, but it was convenient to drop it, because, you know, once you admit that it's a blind process, I think then you open yourself up to a lot more scrutiny, because, I mean, the sorts of material mechanisms that can drive a blind evolutionary process are very limited, and they've had very limited usefulness in explaining systems like Michael Behe considers.
I think we can open it up for those who would like to step up to a mic and ask a question, and go ahead.
Was curious on how old do you perceive the universe to be, and how does carbon dating and their fossil record play into those beliefs? And second, is there any like DNA evidence for Adam and Eve and something like that?
Well, the age of the Earth question is one I tend to sidestep. You know, I'm comfortable with, you know, the standard sorts of chronologies that you get from cosmology and geology. So, you know, 12 billion year universe, 4.5 billion year Earth, 3.8 billion year emergence of the first life forms. You know, I've got colleagues who are young Earth creationists, you know, who will go for 24-hour days of creation, you know, six to 10,000 years back. It's not really an issue for intelligent design as such, because what you're doing with intelligent design is you're looking at features of systems that exhibit signs of intelligence. And those signs of intelligence, whether they were expressed over a 3 billion year period or a 3,000 or a 6,000 year period, you still have to deal with them, you know. And so I've got a fellow I know at a school near Baylor who will say, you know, the difference between the old Earth and young Earth creationists is just a few orders of magnitude. The difference between the theists, those who hold to either of those positions, and the naturalists is an infinite order of magnitudes. You know, because, I mean, there, you know, we're not even talking about the real design anymore with the naturalist. You know, and then with the DNA evidence, I mean, the most common, you know, within, I guess, an older Earth or, you know, standard geological perspective, you know, there's talk of mitochondrial DNA, mitochondrial Eve, mitochondrial DNA, and trying to trace things back. And there you're talking 60 to, you know, maybe 200,000 years. And I think that evidence is now up for grabs. But, you know, I'm not dogmatic about the age of the Earth. I mean, you know, I think science is, you know, everything is up for revision, for reevaluation. But when things go up for reevaluation, there have to be some good reasons for reevaluating it. So, my ears are open, you know, to the evidence. But it's just, you know, we have only so many hours in the day, and for me, the design question, the type of information that points us to intelligence, that's what I want to understand. And I can understand that irrespective of the age questions. So.
Hi. There exists a number, probably a pretty small number, but a number of us at this seminary who share a vision for going to the university after this degree, the Master of Divinity degree, and pursuing the possibility of teaching in the arts, the humanities, generally the humanities, specifically philosophy, history, and English. So my question for you is, and this is based on your experience in the university, what advice do you have for us as we prepare to pursue that endeavor? And then once we're there, what exactly should we expect?
Well, I mean, if you're, you know, I see if you want to become a professor, I think that's a noble profession, and you want to get, you know, you'll have a fair amount of influence in the secular academy, and it's a place we need influence desperately. You know, so I would say go to the best place you can possibly get into. You know, it's good to know what your interests are, know who's there. You know, I mean, so, you know, test out who potential supervisors are going to be, you know, and learn some of the scuttlebutt, because people who can seem very wonderful on paper and in writing can be a real pain to work with, you know, and then you find out that, you know, they haven't had a doctoral student who's finished, you know, in so many years or, you know, or what. So you want to scout things out. Best school doesn't necessarily mean the one with the best reputation, you know, I mean, or best name recognition. You know, it's because you can have some very strong departments that are at schools which, you know, otherwise may not be that well known. I mean, University of Pittsburgh is a solid school, but they've had some of the best philosophy around, you know, so you're talking like top three philosophy programs, even though the school as a whole, I've not known it to be that distinguished. You know, so you want to check around. You know, and I would say learn the discipline. You go there to be socialized into that discipline, see how it operates. I don't mean buy into all the presuppositions. In fact, you want to keep your, you know, have some, be able to keep some distance in your own thinking so you can stay faithful to your Christian commitments. But see how the discipline works, because they're, you know, I think the academy in many ways is quite corrupt, and you want to be there as a leavening, as a, you know, salt and light. I mean, that's one reason to go there. You know, and some disciplines may be easier or more difficult to influence. You know, it's you know, I mean, I don't know the field of lit crit, you know, English that well, but, you know, my understanding is in some programs you're reading about three times as much literary criticisms over the actual novels. You know, now do you want that? Is your purpose to get in there and, you know, subvert the dominant paradigm, or do you want to work with it? You know, so I think just being clear on your purposes. You know, if you were going into evolutionary biology, for instance, you probably would want to keep your head, you know, pretty low. I mean, you play things very close to the vest until you're in a position where you can go public with your views. You know, and then what sort of program? Do you want to go into a program where people are going to be more sympathetic to a Christian worldview? There are places which would be perhaps more sympathetic, places like Notre Dame, University of Dallas, for instance. Or do you want to go into the lion's den? You know, it's. I went to Princeton Seminary because I wanted to know what the mainline theological thinking was like. I wanted to get socialized into that so I could know what I'm dealing with. You know, but it was not a place to go to be nurtured in your faith. You know, I mean, that's what seminary is supposed to be. You know, a seedbed where you get nurtured. You know, and that wasn't why I went there. So just to be aware of, you know, you know what you're trying to get from that education. And I think a good thing is also just to visit the place and start talking to students. You know what that place is really like. You know, but yeah, I think we desperately need more Christians in the university, and also to get networked and get, you know, I know there are faculties where, you know, schools where there are lots of Christians, but they're all sort of scattered around, and there's no critical mass for really influencing the university culture, you know, and that's something to be thinking about as well. You know, so I'm not sure there are any easy answers, but, you know, it's a place, I mean, it's definitely a missionary field. I mean, you look at surveys, you know, I mean, it's just there's a huge disconnect between mass culture and, you know, high culture, if you want to put it that way, you know, sort of academic culture and lay culture, because, you know, look at surveys about belief in God and, you know, traditional values and all of that, you know, people outside the academy, outside the media, you know, it's pretty conservative, traditional. And you go there, and the values are just turned upside down, usually, you know, politically, morally, otherwise. I don't know. Does that help? Anything I can?
I was wondering if you would discuss the similarities and differences between the ID movement and scientific creationism, particularly as espoused by Henry Morris and ICR.
Well, I think we're agreed that natural forces can't do all this creative work. You know, and I've actually visited with John Morris, who's now president at ICR. This was about a year and a half ago. And he commended me. He said, you know, what you're doing is you're showing that Darwinism just can't work. You know, and so he's happy about the work. I think with the scientific creationists, their program is in some ways more ambitious. I mean, they want to establish a lot more. They want, you know, they want to, you know, there's an emphasis on harmonization of scripture and science. You know, they are creationists, so there's an emphasis on the doctrine of creation. You know, so the, and as I've stressed in now two previous talks, that's, you know, you're talking about the source of being. Where does existence come from? You know, the material world. And intelligent design doesn't really speak to that. It speaks to, you know, okay, here we are in an already existing world. What about that world would point me to an intelligence, you know, that's active in the world? But that need not be a creator. And so there are people who are friendly to intelligent design who are not theists, you know. We're not, you know, not even, you know, I mean, not Christian theists. I mean, I know of Jews, you know, I'm thinking of one Jew and one Muslim I know who are very sympathetic, but not even theists at all, you know. So it's a much, you know, it's claiming a lot less, you know. I think everything that intelligent design is claiming, I don't think that, you know, any of our scientific claims, I'm not sure that any creationist would challenge them, you know, saying that, you know, irreducible complexity of various biochemical systems, like what Michael Behe considers, that, you know, he's going to say that that points us to intelligent design. I can't imagine somebody like John Morris, Henry Morris, Dwayne Gish, Ken Ham saying, well, no, really those systems could have come about by natural selection, you know. I mean, I just don't see that. So I don't think anything we're saying, you know, that they would disagree with it. I think the concern is that it doesn't go far enough, that it maybe leaves too much room for evolutionary thinking. But that's, I think, the nature of our enterprise. I think we're in one respect, we're trying to be much more modest. But in one respect, also, I think we're going a lot further, because the very notion of design, which I think, you know, at a philosophical, metaphysical level, the ICR people would readily assent to, I think as a scientific program, as a place for scientific inquiry, they've tended to resist that. Because, I mean, you'll often see that, well, really, neither evolution nor creation are matters that science can investigate, because nobody was there at the time. Or, you know, it's all very circumstantial reasoning. Or, you know, that in, or the design, this is something that's, you know, that's more theological construct or a theological way of looking at things, and you can't really do science with it. And I've seen those sorts of comments within the creationist literature, and I think we want to say no. I mean, design detection, that's something we can do science with. You know, and my sense is, you know, as we, you know, that this is something that creationists, young earth creationists, should find very congenial, and I haven't seen them challenge that. It's you know, I haven't seen anybody say, no, I mean, this design detection doesn't work. I mean, usually, as I said, the concern is it doesn't go far enough, you know. And you know, from my advantage is, you know, sometimes a modest program where you're staking out less territory is a better way to go, because if we can really nail this down, you know, if intelligent design is true, naturalism is dead in the water. You know, if naturalism is dead in the water, then everything is open for reassessment. Darwinism, everything that's been built on Darwinism. Now, you know, do you get the full Christian package deal at that point? No, you don't. But then, you know, but you at least have an opening to start building it and arguing your case. And that really hasn't happened with young earth creationism. I think it's you know, after the court cases in the 80s, I think there was a sense in which there was a loss of cultural engagement. Intelligent design is setting the agenda, you know, for, you know, the terms of the debate. I mean, and this is being admitted now that, you know, this is, publishers are interested in publishing this stuff. People on the other side are engaging it, writing books, and so there's a lot of discussion. And so, you know, I think it's, you know, I encourage young Earth creationists to get on board, you know, work it, and yeah, okay, it doesn't go far enough, but, you know, there's still something good to be done. And, you know, I think, I mean, there's also an issue of, you know, is it worth, you know, sort of an incremental approach to cultural engagement? Because, I mean, often we have our agendas, we have our package deals that we'd like to sell, you know, all in one fell swoop. You know, but sometimes we can't do that. But is there part of the package that at least we can sell, you know, that will be a benefit, you know? And so that, I think that's what intelligent design has to offer. So.
I know that people in the natural sciences, some people, like to set the groundwork for the debate before it starts. How do we as Christians respond to those in the natural sciences who would say that it's impossible to detect design in science because science deals with nature and a designer is beyond nature?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I hear quite a bit. Well, I think, you know, it's true that science is dealing with what happens in nature, okay, with, you know, natural phenomena, the things that are happening there. But that doesn't mean that the things that we invoke as scientific explanations need to have any particular features or characteristics. I mean, scientific explanations, we invoke quarks, cold dark matter. I mean, who has seen cold dark matter? Because precisely because it's cold and dark, you know, it doesn't interact with any of our instruments, and yet we posit it to keep the universe from flying apart. So there are lots of things that we invoke in our scientific explanations, you know. So I think the issue is not, you know, does it meet some arbitrary criterion for what passes as science and what doesn't? I mean, who sets the rules for science in the first place? Yes, you know, if you're looking at an irreducibly complex biochemical system, you're dealing with an aspect of nature. It has certain features that are empirically, you know, I mean, we can discern them empirically. Okay, so then the question is, where does it come from? You know, and design, it's certainly, design is a causal power in the world. I mean, archaeologists need design to distinguish arrowheads from random chunks of rock, to distinguish naturally occurring mounds from burial mounds. You know, so these sorts of distinctions, we draw them. We need them in special sciences already. You know, so why, you know, why put these arbitrary restrictions on it? You know, so I don't. You know, there are many ways to handle that question. You know, and so, you know, the question of, you know, one way is just, you know, just the nature of scientific explanation. You know, in what sense do quarks really exist? You know, I mean, we've got experience of chairs. We don't have experience of these things. I mean, so there's a natural, I mean, one way to approach scientific explanations is to be very pragmatic and say, let's just go with works, what works. And if design explanations are doing useful work for us in science, then, you know, that's sufficient justification for them, as opposed to laying out certain criteria for what scientific explanations must be like. And where do those criteria come from? I mean, the very rules of science, it seems, have been negotiated over time. If you go back 150, 200 years ago, chance had no fundamental place in scientific explanation. Chance was just a way of characterizing our ignorance. You know, everything was deterministic. It was a Newtonian universe, and Laplace had given a decisive mathematical formulation where everything, in fact, he had what was called the Laplacian demon. If you knew exactly what was happening at a given time slice, knew where every particle was positioned and what its momentum was, you could predict the future with perfect certainty and retrodict the past with perfect certainty. All of history would in a sense be contained in that time slice. Now, that's a very deterministic view of the world. That view of the world is dead. You know, with quantum mechanics, chaos theory, you know, that has no place anymore in the natural sciences. So now we have chance as a legitimate mode of explanation, you know, sort of quantum indeterminacy. So what about design? Why shouldn't that be a legitimate mode of explanation? So there are all sorts of ways, I think, to move it. You know, you can point to SETI research, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Here they're intelligent beings. I think the only way to dismiss design is to say that you know in advance that the world started without any intelligence and that intelligence is simply a product of evolution, of a blind evolutionary process. But how do you know that? You're just going to presuppose it? Now, science, it seems, needs to, rather than presuppose what must be the case, should be willing to consider all the logical possibilities on the table, you know, and then sort through them. So anyway, does that help? I mean, it's, you know, because there are lots of ways to approach that question. But, you know, I think whenever I encounter a question like that, there's always the sense, you know, I always get the sense of a wet blanket. You know, it's some, you know, somebody's shutting down inquiry, you know. I mean, you know, the thing is, I mean, the design detection methods that I've developed, they don't have to show that biology is designed. Because, okay, so you've got these criteria for identifying design. Let's move them over to biology and ask, does it show us that they're designed? It may not. You know, it might be that, you know, that biological systems are not, do not submit to these methodologies, that they don't give any evidence of design. You know, in which case, then design would go nowhere. But it, in fact, the way it's going right now is it seems that, in fact, our best indicators are that these systems, biological systems, are designed. So, yeah.
I was wondering what you think the difficulties of intelligent design are that keep a scientist from accepting it.
Well, I think there are a few things that are going on. I mean, when you say keep a scientist from accepting it, I think most scientists really haven't done much study in it. Okay, so I think what's going on in their reluctance even to examine it further are usually, there are a few things that tend to be high on the list. One is just the sense of guilt by association. Isn't intelligent design just, you know, a new fancy way of dressing up creationism? And we know that that's just, you know, nonsense. So, you know, so don't even take it any further. So I think there's that. I think then there's the concern about how can this be science, as in the last question, you know. I mean, doesn't, you know, design, you know, and then you have all these sorts of demarcation arguments that are made. What's in and what's out? The problem with all these demarcation arguments for what's belongs to science and what doesn't is that usually excludes things we want to have in science or includes things we don't want in science. You know, so it's, when philosophers of science have considered these demarcation arguments, I mean, their broad conclusion has been that they just don't work. There's no way to just say what's in and what's out. You know, and then I think one of the biggest stumbling blocks, and I've had it put to me, I mean, I was on a PBS program called Uncommon Knowledge some time back. This was taped on the Stanford campus. This was December of 2001. And so there was this theologian who does a lot of work in science and theology, Rob Russell, was on the program. And he says, you know, you can't believe in design, you're a Christian. I said, you know, I'm thinking, what's going on here? He says, well, you know, Christian God is good, and look at all this bad design in the world. And you know, from my end, okay, let's look at features of the world. Do they point us to an intelligence behind it? Okay, if yes, then we've got to deal with it. But from his end, it was like, okay, if you're a theist, Christian theist, then you hold to a certain view of God. That God would have to design things in certain ways. But look at the world. It didn't come out that way. So there's this contradiction, and therefore, you know, there's no design in the world. So, and that sort of argument, broadly speaking, falls under what could be called dysteleology. Dys, the D-Y-S, is in dysfunction. You know, it's that there are instances of design or apparent design which no self-respecting designer would have brought about, and so, you know, so you can dismiss design off right off. Now, I think there are ways of dealing with bad design and wicked design. I mean, you know, there are things, you know, certain parasites really seem well adapted to doing a number on their host organisms. You know, I mean, it looks almost demonic, you know. Now, I think from a Christian perspective, we have a whole doctrine of the fall to appeal to for why designs have gone dysfunctional. But I think that's a real stumbling block for people. You know, that somehow there's all, if there's design, then there's a lot of wicked design. You know, there are lots of things that happen which seem downright cruel, and so rather than deal with that problem, just dismiss the prospect of design entirely. You know, and I think it's way too easy because you look at the natural world, you've got things that look cobbled together, maybe vestigial structures, although I think those are pretty minimal. You've got some examples of exquisite design. I'll be looking at some of those tonight in my lecture. And then you've got some wicked design, or it looks like very nasty stuff. You know, rabies virus, you look at it, it looks like it's designed to really mess up your nervous system. Now, how do you deal with all of that? You know, but I think you have to deal with it within a broader theological and philosophical context and not just dismiss design because, it's bad design and any designer that you might invoke couldn't have done it that way. Well, that's just an a priorism. You know, I mean, that's what one of these books on fallacies calls an argument from invincible ignorance. I mean, you'll never be able to see the design that's there because you've just defined it out of existence.
You mentioned during your lunchtime talk that it's no good to just critique a worldview without positively asserting something in its place. And then you mentioned this morning during chapel that each worldview has four components, questions of origin, a predicament, mm-hmm. some sort of solution to the predicament, and then mm-hmm. some sort of eschatology.
Right.
I'm just wondering, what does the design movement assert positively in light of those four categories, and how does the design movement plan on setting up even just a basis for a worldview without being self-consciously Christian?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure you can get, you know, a full-blown worldview just out of intelligent design because it is a pretty minimalist movement, minimalist program. I mean, it's saying that there is this intelligence, but I think for a full worldview, I think you're going to need to flesh it out. You know, but I think it's going to be relevant at a lot of these different levels or different aspects of the worldview. And one of the things, for instance, that's coming out, you know, this problem of dysteleology, bad design. You know, it's the pattern that I'm seeing. Now, I'm not sure it's going to be borne out. Is that usually the bad design is something that emerges out of an initially good design. Okay, so it's design being subverted. It's not just that the torture chamber is built from scratch. Okay, it's that the bad design, you know, the things that are nasty, end up being gotten from things that initially were good. And I'll deal with one example in my lecture tonight. I'll look at a bacterial flagellum, and then also a certain type of pump that pumps toxins into organisms, into host, you know, into cells. And those two seem to be related. You know, there's some genes that are the same in both of them, and yet it seems that the pump, which actually, I mean, this is the mechanism by which the bubonic plague killed a third of the population of Europe in the 1300s or 1400s, 1300s. That's that mechanism seems to have evolved it seems to be the subversion of this initially this bacterial flagellum, which is a motility structure. It helps the bacterium to get through its environment. I think intelligent design will be relevant in questions of morality, ethics, trying to build a natural law. You know, what is our natural good? You know, I think you can start posing that. I think you can look at it theologically, certainly, but you can look at it also empirically. I mean, what works? You know, what sorts of lifestyles work? What sorts of consequences do they have? And if there is a design plan for us, what ends up being our natural goods? So, so I think it'll, working out our, fulfilling our good or our end or our purposes, that would certainly be part of a redemption, the solution to the problem. So I think it'll figure into these various aspects of the worldview, but I don't think it's going to be complete. I think you have to, there's going to have to be more to it. For me as a Christian, intelligent design is going to, it's going to fit nicely into a Christian worldview. But the revelation of God in Jesus Christ, intelligent design is really silent on that. I can make sense out of intelligent design in light of thinking of Jesus as the Logos of God. But in terms of just, I look at the data of nature which points me to intelligence, how is that going to tell me about Christ and the tomb and the resurrection and the redemption that are in Christ? It doesn't really. So I think it's going to be part of hammering out a worldview. And I think it's really going to be on the Christians to incorporate intelligent design, use it to form, Christian worldview, a theology of nature. I think this is one of the things that's going to happen. If intelligent design goes as far as I think it does in transforming the scientific landscape, then there are going to be a lot of other theologies and philosophies which are going to be co-opting it. And I'm already seeing some of this, New Age thinking, various non-Christian groups, finding these ideas attractive. And so I think there'll be an apologetic which will be based on, okay, now that intelligent design is accepted, okay, now how do we adjudicate among these various worldviews that are being built around it or utilizing it? So does that help, or anything you want to pursue on that?
I'm just trying to figure out how, because I initially am very excited about the movement, but since it's divorced from a self-consciously Christian worldview, I have a hard time as a Christian getting ultimately excited about it. Like, for example, say intelligent design prevails, and then another predominant worldview is set up that's based on that, but it's not Christian at all. Will the intelligent design movement as it is feel some sort of success? Or...
Well, I think it's up to the Christian community to run with it. I mean, all the key players in the intelligent design movement are Christian, right? So what would happen? I mean, how could that happen, that intelligent design as a movement gets taken over by another worldview? I don't know. I mean, the Mormons going to take it over, the Jungians, the New Agers, who's going to do that? I think, if anything, it's for the Christians to take these ideas and use them, to do some constructive work in theology. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff to be done, I mean, in terms of divine action. But I think, it's intelligent design, it takes you so far, okay? But then I think you have to take your theological background and bring it in conversation with intelligent design. Now, it seems to me that's much healthier than saying, okay, intelligent design takes us all the way to the Judeo-Christian God, because it can't, And I think, but this has been the temptation in natural theology in the past. And then you have people like Karl Barth and others who will criticize it and say, get rid of any sort of use of nature in theological work, This seems to me a way of bridging the two in a way that's, that makes good sense, and that's faithful to the scriptures, and saying, what does nature tell us, about God? But I think we then need to do some theological work. So yeah, I mean, I think the intelligent design could be derailed, but if anything, it seems to me that's reason for Christian theologians to get excited and to do the theological work. Interpret it, frame it in a way where it is something that Christians can own, because it seems to me that it's very, I mean, fundamental to intelligent design is the idea that there is intelligence in the world, and these the fundamental defining characteristic of intelligence is that they create information. It's a certain type of information, but it's that they create information. Now, information in that sense, I mean, it seems that there's a very natural connection with the Logos theology of John's Gospel. I mean, there's lots of rich connections there, you know, and so there's some good theological work to be done. You know, and that's, by the way, being resisted now by theologians. You see, because I think the tendency among a lot of theologians, mainline theologians, is that evolution is just fine. We've made our peace with it. Let's move on. Don't reopen these questions. And if you're a God who is a designer, for I think a lot of the mainline theologians, is somebody who just is just too close for comfort. And so there's a lot of criticism now of intelligent design that it's bad theology. And I think we really need some theologians to say, no, it's good theology. Or at least it's compatible with a good theology. You know, because I mean the line that I'm seeing more and more now is that it's, you know, it's not compatible with a good theology. You know, intelligent design is not a panacea, it's not a magic bullet. There's still gonna be heresies after it wins the day. You know, But it's certainly going to clear the ground of this suffocating naturalistic ideology, which seems to have a very good track record of taking young Christians and derailing them in their faith when they go to the academy. You know, and I think that's going to stop. I think that's really going to stop.
I was going to ask you, what book would you recommend for somebody that's maybe well steeped in the university system and naturalism, that's very educated and high in regards to science, mathematics, things like that? What book would you give them to say, hey, check this out and see what you think?
Yeah, I mean, just one book, I don't know. I mean, it depends. I mean, Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box, I think is a real good one if you've got somebody with an interest in biology. I have a book, No Free Lunch, which is pretty high-powered, but lays out my program for design detection and then applies it to biology. Jonathan Wells' Icons of Evolution, where he shows just how evidences for evolution, which are used standard textbook evidences, one after another, just collapses. You know, either because the evidence has been faked or misrepresented, or so that's a useful book, although that's mainly criticism. You know, but I'm not sure one book is going to do it. I think as a first introduction, there's a little book I edited called Signs of Intelligence, which has a bunch of essays by a lot of the key players in the design movement. That might be good, just, you know, say, hey, look at this. You think there's anything there? You know, because they're pretty accessible essays, and then see where the interest lies.
As sort of the future of the movement, do you have kind of a feeling of a timetable? Do you obviously feel that it will be, you know, broadly accepted by scientific community, hopefully at one point? What do you kind of see as a timetable on that?
Yeah, timetables are tough. I think timetables in this day of the internet get accelerated because it's hard to keep information at bay. I think several things are going to be happening. I think there's going to be a younger generation, homeschoolers, Christians, who are going to have this information in hand, and they're not going to get derailed, I think, as they have in the past, because I think not only will they have tools to critique what they're being taught, but they're going to have, you know, a positive program for intelligent design to bring to the table. So I think that's going to be very effective, but that takes time. I mean, once you finish high school, to get a PhD, it's usually about 10 years, you go through undergraduate 4 years, maybe 5 years PhD, so about 10 years, 5-6 years. So that's happening, and I think we've got now, there's also a sense in which there are now, You know, we're networked. We've got various communities that people can tie into. And so I think that's going to be happening more and more. Now, the scientific community, I think they're really digging in their heels. You know, I'll talk about this tomorrow when I give a talk on what I call the design revolution, but just to, as a little foreshadowing, it seems that ideas and their reception go through several stages, and this has been characterized variously by a number of different people, but I would put it this way. The idea, it starts out where it's largely, it's not even really on people's radar. It's just sort of out there. You know, and it's regarded as, I had a little alliteration. I have to look at that again. But anyway, it's just largely dismissed, but it's considered pretty ridiculous. Then it gets into enough of the public consciousness inside of a consciousness where it's considered pernicious. Okay, it's, now this is stuff that needs to be stamped out. And then there's sort of grudging acceptance that, well, maybe there's something here, or it's not entirely out to lunch, but, it's probably not very interesting. And then finally, it's, well, we always told you so. It's just part of the way we think of the world. Now, I think we're at that crucial stage where it's coming to be regarded as pernicious. This is dangerous, needs to be stamped out. And so you have Scientific American article, 15 answers to creationist nonsense, and intelligent design is singled out there. AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, issues a statement saying that intelligent design is pseudoscience, should not be taught. Various scientific bodies now, scientists signing their names saying this stuff needs to be kept out. Now that, on one level you can say, well, gee, isn't this terrible? On the other hand, though, I think it points up just how status quo Darwinism is. I mean, the theory has a lot of problems, and I'll be going through some of this tonight. So that actually is an invitation to the rebelliousness of youth to say, hey, jump in and start taking on this old encrusted way of looking at things. So, now how fast is that going to happen? It could happen very fast. I was born in 1960. I saw the demise of the Soviet Empire. I've got relatives in Poland, relatives in what was at the time West Berlin. I saw the oppressiveness. I saw just how invincible this, communist system looked. And then, 1989, the Berlin Wall falls. I'd been at the Berlin Wall. I'd seen it. It seemed like this was going to be here forever, and it wasn't. So things can change very quickly. And I think what's going to hasten it is I've got some colleagues who are doing now some fundamental research in intelligence. And it's not all just saying, okay, there's signs of intelligence, there we go. It's doing some nuts and bolts research with various biological systems, showing the design characteristics, showing just what the sorts of obstacles really are to the Darwinian mechanism, and doing the hard research. I think a number of research themes or sorts of questions you can start posing within a design framework. And once that starts being worked, if that's where the interesting problems are, if that's where scientists are able to do interesting research, then I think people are just going to vote with their feet. They'll say, Darwinism just isn't where the exciting stuff is happening. When that happens, I think it's over. So I think that's where it's going to go. Now that could happen very quickly if we have some breakthroughs. And I'm looking to one colleague of mine in particular, who apparently has some really dynamite research. He's putting it almost in apocalyptic terms. So if it's as good as he's saying, and I've seen already previews of it, but things could happen. But I think you're going to have you're going to have the old guard, people who've made their reputations, doing it the old way, who are going to be holding on to power as long as they can. People have quipped about how ideas change and and new ideas take hold. And I think the economist Samuelson was saying that, it's new ideas progress funeral by funeral. It's like, the old guard has to die off. And Max Planck also said something to that effect. You know, so it's, you know, so it's, you know, I mean, it's interesting. You look back. I mean, Darwin seemed to have won the day very quickly. I'm not sure that's going to happen with intelligent design. That it's just going to be, you know, the field will be swept clean. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think it's, I think we're looking at a major shakeup, and in part because, you know, I mean, yes, you know, we're coming with a new vision, but also you've got, you know, I think you're dealing with an emperor's new clothes phenomenon here. You know, I mean, this is a theory that's been way oversold, you know, and I think the criticisms are now going to be, they're building up, you know, and I think they're going to get remorseless after a while. And people are going to have to back down. I mean, I just see what's happening, you know, because I watch this debate. You know, there's one of the slides I'll be putting up tonight is that of a bacterial flagellum. This has been one of the systems that's become the mascot of the intelligent design movement. It's one of these nano-engineered, you know, molecular machines that's inside certain bacteria. And, you know, this has been now, we've been pushing this for six and a half years. The other side, you know, they're clueless about how this system, how systems like this come about. And not just about this system, but across the board, you know, because, I mean, this is not an isolated system, you know. So you've got a systemic, you know, pervasive inability of a theory that's supposed to account for all of biological complexity, you know, to account for, you know, systems without which life would be impossible, you know. Now, That's a gaping hole in a theory, you know. I think, and to push that point, I think we're getting a lot of mileage out of that. You know, so, for people who are convinced, you know, that design is not even, you know, is not even a possibility, that it's unthinkable, you know, these sorts of criticisms don't hold much water. But for those who are keeping an open mind, I think they hold a lot of weight.